Here in the Northern Rockies, dark winter months are outlasted in basements, dens, and nooks, where kindred souls gather to share intel, swap fly patterns, and relive the memories from seasons past. This gathering spot, known locally as a February room, is the inspiration for this podcast. No matter the season, the door is always open to those with a fly fishing story to tell. Brought to you by CD Fishing USA, the North American distributor for Composite Development's fly rods and fishing accessories. Tech, precision, ingenuity, legacy. Go to cdfishing.us and follow us on Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook. Here's your host, Lauren Carnop, and this is the February Room.
Well, Justin Carnop here, and welcome to the February Room. Today we have the pleasure of speaking with a renowned regional expert on the pursuit of striped bass and trophy striped bass at that. Obviously, as we peel back the onion, we will discover more today, but he is an author, a guide, a fly designer from Georgia. Henry Cowan, welcome to the show.
Hey, Justin. Thanks for having me on the February Room.
Well, we appreciate you taking the time to be here. Like most anglers, you wear many hats to keep the dream alive, right?
Yeah, you got it. You know, you got to be versatile.
Yeah, that's true. You know, based on your book and website, it would appear that you were something of a specialist in terms of focusing on one species. But like most guides and those with a fishing problem, you've done a fair bit of traveling around, and I'm sure there's some interesting stories from your home waters as well. So if you wouldn't mind sharing a memory with us from your travels.
Well, sure. So, you know, I'm a New York City kid who ended up down here in Georgia, in Atlanta. But, you know, I grew up in New York City and, you know, fished all around the Big Apple. I mean, literally in Brooklyn, New York is where I grew up. So I cut my teeth saltwater fishing for striped bass. For those people that haven't gotten to New York, you know, New York is one of the best playgrounds for fishing in the United States. It's not just the concrete jungle. We have some fantastic striper fishing in that tri-state area, especially in the city. And so eventually I married a Southern girl, migrated down south here to Georgia, and started pursuing striped bass in freshwater, which differ greatly. Even though they look the same, they differ greatly from striped bass in saltwater when pursuing them. So, you know, one of my most fond memories is, and I'll just lead up to this, and I call this fishing forbidden waters. And what I mean by forbidden waters is anglers have gone for years and fished places that, maybe you shouldn't be, let's call it. Let's say, you know, I'm not talking about going in and trespassing on, you know, somebody's ranch and going into their trout water. I would never, ever do something like that. But for instance, as a kid growing up in New York, in my late teenage years, early 20s, we used to fish this place called Lilco, which was the Long Island Lighting Company, and it was a hot water outflow. It made electricity for Long Island. And in the winter, when all the striped bass would migrate back down south and make their run south, there were a bunch of fish that would stay in Long Island all winter because the hot water outflow coming from this electricity plant would keep the bait and the stripers there, and we would sneak into the area that we weren't supposed to fish inside the power plant, which was on Long Island Sound, and catch fish all winter long at night, and nobody would ever see us. And I call that forbidden waters, you know, and everybody's got some forbidden waters. You know, I'm sure you probably got some spots yourself, Justin, that you fished that, you know, maybe weren't really open for the public, but you got in there because you knew there was some good fishing. Is that fair to say?
Oh, something like that probably occurred.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when we fished up in the Croton Reservoir in New York, one of the best runs on the whole Croton was behind a Honda dealership, and you had to go into the Honda dealership behind it, go past the cars and go out there, you know, out their back door and walk down to the river to fish one of the best stretches on the river. And, you know, that's forbidden waters to me. So my story that I'm going to tell you happened to me the week of 9/11 back in 2001. And I was already down here in Atlanta and fishing Lake Lanier for stripers. And right after 9/11 happened, I was actually up in New York when that occurred. And I got back that Saturday after 9/11, which was about 4 or 5 days later. And I went out the next morning fishing on Sunday. I took my boat out, and our lake is 38,000 acres, 650 miles of shoreline, loaded with striped bass. And what the Army Corps of Engineers did to prevent terrorism at that time was they cordoned off the dam on the south end of Lake Lanier, where they put barrels up about a quarter of a mile across the lake. And it just said, do not enter. And that stretch of where the barrels were that said, do not enter, was probably about 2,000 yards away from the dam, because they didn't want anybody getting near the dam. They were fearful of a terrorist attack, that somebody would blow up the dam and that would flood all of Atlanta. So, because that's Atlanta's drinking water. So one of my really most fun memories was I was down there fishing, and I had one of my very dear friends, Dennis Ficco, in the boat. And we were down on the south end of the lake looking for fish in September that would be on top. And lo and behold, we're down by the barrels going across the lake, and inside the barrels, about halfway to the dam, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, like coming up from the depths, we see about 500 striped bass just absolutely start tearing up the water. I mean, it was a full-on blitz. And I looked at Dennis and I said, Dennis, get your rod out, strip line out, we're going in. And Dennis looks at me and he's like, are you kidding me? It says do not enter. I said, Dennis, there's nobody here. It's Sunday morning. It's 7:30. Get your line out. We're going in.
Do not enter was just merely a suggestion.
It was a suggestion. Every barrel had the sign that said do not enter. So all of a sudden, I'm in my little, at that point, I was fishing out of a 17-foot 1966 Boston Whaler, an old refurbished Boston Whaler. And so I get Dennis in the bow of the boat, he strips line out, and I run in between a couple of barrels, and I'm running halfway to the dam, and the fish are just, it looks like somebody's got a blender on the top of the water. If you've never seen a striper blitz, you know, Google Montauk fly fishing, you know, in the fall, and you'll see what these blitzes look like when the fish are just tearing it up. It's a wonderful sight. And we get those little mini blitzes like that, you know, with much fewer fish than they do in Montauk. You know, Montauk can get 20,000 fish on top. We probably had 500 that morning. And so I pull up to the side of the fish, put the boat broadside so Dennis can make a perfect cast into the blitz. I don't think he got to his second back cast, Justin. And all of a sudden, out from behind the dam comes a boat with three engines, about a 28, 30-foot boat with three engines on the back, sirens blazing along with lights flashing. And there's a guy on the front of the boat with a 30-caliber machine gun. And he's in the front of the boat with the captain driving towards us. And I'm like, Dennis, sit down. We got to make a run for it. I don't think we even got back to the barrels in time by the time this INS boat came out of nowhere and plugged us down. And the captain on the boat has got a badge on, and he looks at me. He goes, I don't want to say anything that I'm not allowed to say on this podcast. But he looked at me, and I'll just calm it down. I'll make it children's legible. He looked at me, goes, are you freaking out of your mind? He goes, do you know that we are allowed to shoot when we see you here? Didn't you see the sign on those barrels? And Dennis looks at me, and I look at the captain, and I said, did you see all those stripers on top on the water before you came blaring out? That had to be 500 fish on the top. And he's shaking his head, and Dennis looks at him, and Dennis is a little older than me. Dennis looks at him, and Dennis is a very, very honest and high integrity guy. He points his finger at me and he looks at the captain. He says, I told him not to go. I told him we shouldn't be doing this, blah, blah, blah. And there was another boat that had followed me in behind me who came in and saw what we did. And out of the blue, I didn't see him until he came in behind me on top of the fish. And then he ran the other way. And I just looked at the officer. I said, don't you think you should go let that guy know that he came in illegally too? And he's shaking his head going, he goes, this is a warning. He goes, I don't want to see you behind these barrels again. But we never did get to make one cast at those fish. But I will just tell you that when you see a gala of fish on top like that, just tearing up the water, whether it's stripers or false albacore or whatever they are, I say, you know, everything else becomes secondary. You know, your goal is to get to those fish and get some feathers to throw in the middle of that whole thing. It would have been an absolute field day. So that's kind of one of my favorite stories of fishing, quote unquote, forbidden waters.
Yeah, that's a gamble there, buddy. That's a gamble.
Well, you know, you were just hoping that the guy in the INS boat was a fisherman and would have just backed off, but obviously he wasn't. And those fish continued to come up several times when we were behind the barrels and there's just nothing we could do. We just had to leave and go find some other fish that morning. But I want to say that was around September 16th, 2001, that happened. That today that Dennis, when I speak to Dennis, here we are, you know, almost 20 years later, and he'll never forget that story. You know, he'll take that to the grave. That was one of the great fishing stories that we've had on our lake. I've had several of those, by the way, those types of encounters. And, you know, like I said, you do what you got to do. You don't want to be, I would never trespass someplace that I wasn't invited. I would never do anything like that. But, you know, getting into an area just to catch a few fish and quietly leave without disturbing. I mean, come on, are you kidding me? You know, that's what a good guy does. You put your people in fish, you know?
Right, right. I got to go several years ago to Maine, and this guy met me. I had just kind of hooked up with him right before I went out there for a separate work trip. And this fellow that I took fishing here with his grandkid recommended I reach out to this gentleman. And, you know, he might just take me on a fishing trip. And so we met at the mouth of the Kennebec. Well, he picked me up in the town of Bath, brought me a burger, and drove me up to the mouth of the Kennebec.
Love it. I fished there many a time up by Popham Beach in that area.
Yeah, boy, it was incredible, man. The first fish that came in that I was fortunate enough to put a fly in front of, and the fish ate it, and it was in, you know, like shin deep water, like bone fishing kind of style. More, I was not aware that you could have a striper experience kind of like that. It was incredible.
Yeah, they're just a fantastic species. You know, whether you're fishing for them in salt water or like we do down here in freshwater. You know, it gives you, you know, I am somewhere around 250 miles from the coast, yet I can have a saltwater experience on my lake. And that's the beauty of striper fishing in fresh water, is it allows you to have a saltwater experience when you're nowhere near salt water, and you get the birds and you get fish blasting on top. And it's just so exciting. The only difference between that and salt water is you're fishing a lake, so the boat doesn't rock, you know?
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, that's really cool. You know, they had stripers in some of the lakes around where I grew up in Oregon, and we didn't spend a ton of time targeting them, but we sure gave it hell, and it was not easy. They always seemed to be kind of down deep, or we weren't timing things right. But for whatever reason, we didn't have a lot of success doing that. I'd like to go back and try again someday. But anyway, on along those lines, tell me about your guide service.
Well, so, you know, I'm here just north of Atlanta. I'm up in Cumming, Georgia. And, you know, my fishery mostly is Lake Lanier. I also fish another lake, a little bit smaller lake called Lake Allatoona, which is also just north of Atlanta. I'm about 45 minutes north of Atlanta. And on Lake Lanier, we have striped bass, freshwater striped bass. And we also have a species called Kentucky spotted bass. And a lot of people haven't heard of Kentucky spotted bass. They are, if you look at a Kentucky spot, they kind of look like a largemouth, but they act exactly like a smallmouth. But their markings just tend to look more largemouth-like, but they don't. They pull a lot harder and they jump. And We have a world-class Kentucky spotted bass fishery. We actually own two of the seven line class records for Kentucky spots in the United States are on our lake, on Lake Lanier. So for us, it's like smallmouth fishing, and we can get, you know, most Kentucky spots are probably in somewhere between 30 and 35 lakes around the United, 35 states around the United States. You can find them in a lot of states across the country. But we have some of the top spotted bass fishing right here in North Georgia on Lake Lanier, and they just pull like the dickens. It's a great fish. And so that's what I fish out of. And then when I go to Alatoona, I fish for hybrids. There are stripers in Lake Alatoona, but it is loaded with hybrids. So when we get topwater hybrid bites, I'll take my micro skiff over there, and we'll fish for hybrids, which differ from stripers. They're a little more aggressive. Those are fish that are actually, they're a combination when they're not self-reproducing fish. Those have to be stocked. And hybrids are a combination between a white bass and a striped bass. They actually take the eggs from one and the sperm from the other, and they put it together and come up with a hybrid. Some people call them vipers and wipers and all sorts, but they're all hybrids. And so I fish for them a little bit here in North Georgia. And then my favorite thing I love to do is in the summertime, I get down on I go below Lake Lanier into the Chattahoochee River, which is one of the two rivers that runs through our lake. And I take people down on the Chattahoochee River, and we fish off the river on the Oxbow Lakes, which are flats next to the river itself. And we carp fish. We sight fish for carp, poling around in a skiff. You'd think you were bone fishing. The water's not quite as clear as, say, a bonefish flat, but it's a little tannic, but not tannic enough that, you know, when you're pulling around in 10 inches of water, you can see them swimming all around. And I just love, you know what? I like to fish, Justin, where water used to be. You can't get me shallow enough to go fishing.
Sorry, I didn't catch whether or not that Kentucky spotted bass is a native species, or is that a hybrid fish, or is that
its own species of fish. It's not a hybrid. It's a native species that's here. Some people call them Kentucky spotted bass. Some people call them Alabama spotted bass. But they are spotted bass. And believe it or not, for guys that are interested in the bass fishing tournaments, you know, we've got them all over the country, obviously. When you see whether it's the BASS or whether it's the FLW, or now the new one is the World Fishing League, I think it is, or something like that, where you get all these professional bass anglers. The three bass that they allow to be caught in these tournaments are either largemouth, smallmouth, or spotted bass, Kentucky spots. Those are the three species allowed in these tournaments across the country. And so they don't get, Kentucky spots don't get anywhere near as big as largemouth. You know, you hear about people catching 10 and 12 pound largemouth bass, where Kentucky spots are more similar to the size of a smallmouth, which means it's going to be anywhere from 1 to 5 pounds. But we have, you know, if you caught a 4 pound smallmouth on any river or lake in the United States, somebody would look and go, wow, that's a fantastic fish. Our Kentucky spots on my lake, if you catch a 4 pounder, that's just an average big fish that nobody raises an eyebrow. Everybody looks and goes, really nice fish, but that's not a jaw dropper. You know, anything over 5 to 6 is considered a jaw dropper. So we have a really special Kentucky spotted bass fishery up here as well. But I'm mainly known for targeting stripers. That's what I do. But I love what we call the green fish, the bass. I love catching them too. They're just a lot of fun. And in the summertime up here on Lanier, while we don't catch the real, real big ones that time of year, these are mostly 1 to 3 pound fish, but it's all on 6 weight rods and, you know, floating lines and poppers, you know, just throwing any sort of a popper or a pole dancer, you know, a walk the dog kind of fly like Charlie Bishrot's pole dancer, you'll drive these fish crazy. It's really a lot of fun.
So one of the rivers near where I grew up in Central Oregon was, it's called the John Day. And the John Day was a really fun smallmouth fishery. Now, it was kind of a numbers game, but there was, you know, like the state record came out of there, which was like 7.25 pounds or something. So I kind of grew up doing a lot of that popper fishing for smallies, and it's still definitely one of my favorite methods and favorite fish to target. We do have some opportunity around here in Montana for smallies too. I did get to go to, I have had occasion to fish up in like the North Woods of Wisconsin and on the Mississippi and some of those other rivers up there where they attain a bigger, you know, size class, and they're a real dark green bass, as opposed to the ones kind of out west tend to be like a lighter green, and they just don't get that depth and girth and everything. Are those smallies that you guys have down there kind of that real like dark green variety with the red eyes, or what do they look like?
So interesting you say that. Our spotted bass are, they look, I'm telling you, from the looks of them, if I showed you a spot and I showed you a largemouth, you almost couldn't tell the difference, except that a largemouth, you can tell a little bit from the markings, because the markings on a spotted bass are definitely darker and more defined. The spot going down, there's a line of spots that go down his lateral line in the middle that you can tell the difference between a largemouth and a Kentucky spot. But the easiest way to tell, obviously, is if you were to look at where his jaw, the middle of his jaw, where he opens his mouth, the crease in the back of his mouth, on a largemouth, that crease goes to just around the eye or just behind the eye on a largemouth, whereas on a smallmouth or a Kentucky spot, it's in front of that eye because they just don't have that big mouth. And so you can see just from the alignment of the jaw crease, you can tell whether you've got, if you weren't able to look at something and go, oh, that's a largemouth or that's a spot, that would be the easiest way to tell for certain.
Gotcha. Yeah, I'm looking this up right now for reference here. It's interesting how, you know, you can kind of be around anglers for most of your life, and then there's these little regional things that you never hear about.
I have never heard about
Kentucky spotted bass.
Well, we also have a bass down here, a species called a shoal bass, S-H-O-A-L. And those look exactly like smallmouths. You almost can't tell the difference. And we have them, they're native to Georgia only. And you catch them in rivers. And we have a great river fishery just north and just south of Atlanta for shoal bass. And they're another, just a native species you can't catch anywhere else in the country. And they're fantastic. They are just like, I mean, again, you look at a shoal bass and you look at a smallmouth, and some guys can't tell the difference. They've got the red eye and the whole nine yards. My spots don't. My spots clearly look like more like a largemouth, clearly look more like it. But when you're fighting one, you would swear you were fighting a smallmouth because they just dog it and dig and pull, and they just don't give up. You know, a largemouth, I'm not dissing any fish. I love all fish with fins. But a largemouth, the beautiful thing about a largemouth bass is, especially if you're fishing a popper, it's one of the great takes in fly fishing, is catching a largemouth on a popper. Once you hook them, you know, it's almost like fighting, for lack of a better term, and not to sound disrespectful, it's like fighting a boot full of urine, you know. But whereas a Kentucky spot will dog it all. I mean, he's got attitude. There's no question.
Okay, I've never heard that analogy before. I might have to, if I borrow that from you in the future, do I have to pay your royalties on that one?
No. You can, that's just, we've just heard that. Listen, you're out in Montana, so I know you're fishing for a lot of fish that have dots on them. You know, you're fishing browns and rainbows, and I love, you know, having grown up in the Northeast, you know, I love my trout. Unfortunately, here in the South, while we do have a great trout fishery down here in Atlanta, believe it or not, we're as far south as we are. We have a natural reproducing brown trout fishery in the Chattahoochee River below Lake Lanier, inside Metro Atlanta. self-sustaining naturally. They haven't stocked a brown trout in that river in probably 15 years. And every year, some of the gear guys are pulling out fish between 10 and 18 pounds out of this wow. out of this river. But that being said, and you know, I don't fish a lot of trout down here anymore, just because I was a dry fly snob up in the Northeast. I just, you know, Justin, if you put me on a river in Montana and said, if you streamer fish or you nymph fish, you'll catch 30 fish today. But if you dry fly fish, you may only catch 5. I'd spend all day catching 5 fish. I'm good. I am so good with dry fly fishing. I either like to fish super skinny or on top. That's my, if I was not guiding, that's what I would be doing. So, you know, that's the beauty anyway. Coming back, that's the beauty of a largemouth fishery is that, you know, during the right time of year, you can fish them on top. And it's one of the great takes, you know?
Yeah, I fully 100% agree with everything you said there as far as the largemouth eat goes. Yeah, you know, I find myself, it's funny you mentioned that because I do guide trout. But if I have days to fish, I more often than not go target pike or try to find a bass lake, or I go smallmouth fishing. Because I love all that stuff too. And, you know, just like you, there's not a fish with fins that I don't want to go after. But just when you're guiding for trout all the time, when you have your personal days to get out, sometimes it's nice to go explore something else. And pike are delicious eating too. And, you know, we'll save some smallmouth in some of these rivers where it's going to probably be better for the population if you take some of those, you know, 13, 14 inches out of there.
Well, you know, if you like eating pike, you know, if you mixed it with a little carp, you'd have yourself your gefilte fish.
Okay, well, I'll take your word for that.
Yeah, that's you get that up in New York, you know?
Well, these shoal bass are really beautiful. I've just been looking at images of them here.
Yeah, they're real pretty. They're real pretty. And we fished that in, I don't personally guide for that, but my buddies up at Unicoi Outfitters in North Georgia do guide trips for those fish. And in the summertime, they'll take you out in starting around the end of June through most of August as that water gets lower in the summer. These fish in the river, you're fishing a river that's probably no more, you'll be in a raft, you know, a two-man plus the rower, so a three-man raft. You'll go down the river. I don't think it's 120 feet from one side of the river to the other, and all you'll do is throw poppers, you know, and you know, boogle bugs and stealth bombers, and it's all on top in the summertime, and it's just great fun on 6 weights. Here in North Georgia. So we, you know, Georgia has a pretty diverse fishery, all things considered, you know, considering we're not near the ocean. And I'm, like I said, I'm a dyed in the wool saltwater guy, but I've made do. I married a Southern girl, ended up down here. And so now I'm taking advantage of what Atlanta has to offer. And so we have good striper fishing, good bass fishing, pretty good trout fishing, I'd say too. And then, the carp fishing, I just, you know, that to me is the bomb. I just can't get enough of that. I can't wait till May comes around and I break out the little towy, technical skiff and just pull around, and 10 inches of water is just, to me, there's just no more fun than doing that.
Well, you guys do have that Cumberland Island area, right? That I got to go there one time. That was a really beautiful place.
That is a pretty place down on the shore. Yeah. That, I mean, Georgia has some beautiful coast. There's no question. And they get, you know, down there, they got a great red fishery, along with, they get some tarpon, that they're learning how to figure out how to fly fish for tarpon down there. They've been catching them for years on bait and stuff, but they're starting to really do a good job with tarpon. And then they have everything else, the sea trout and, you know, flounder and, jacks and some false albacore a little bit, some bonita, some ladyfish and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, it's a pretty good mix. It's a pretty good mix down on the coast. But again, like I said, we're 250 miles from the coast, so our saltwater fishery is Lake Sydney Lanier and our stripers, and you know, that's an 8-9 weight fishery because our fish average between 6 and 8 pounds, and catching 12, 14, 15 pound stripers is not all that uncommon. And we're going through a stage right now where we're seeing smaller fish versus larger fish over the last probably 4 or 5 years. You know, when I, up until about 5, 6, 7 years ago, catching fish into the mid upper teens was not unusual, and catching fish in the 20s on fly. You know, my biggest fish that I've got on the fly up there was 28 pounds, but I saw one that went 38 pounds. But, you know, that's a great fishery for a freshwater fish and a fly rod. Just they pull great, and they're just a wonderful, wonderful fish. You know, and it's becoming, you know, striper fishing in freshwater is becoming really, really popular now around the country. And so that's kind of what led to, you know, having the book come out recently as well.
Yeah, let's talk about that book a little bit.
Well, so about 3 years ago, I got a phone call from one of my dear friends who's unfortunately not around anymore. Lefty Cray was a very dear friend of mine. I used to speak to Lefty just about every 2 or 3 weeks. We would get on the phone for 20 minutes and jaw just to check up on each other. And one day I got a phone call, and Lefty called me in the, I don't remember when it was, March or April of 17. And he said, Henry, I'm getting so many emails and letters from people about stripers and hybrids in fresh water. And, you know, there's nothing with regards to fly fishing written on them. And we need a book. The industry needs a book. And he goes, you need to write the book. He goes, you are so dialed in, and you have such good friends with other striper guys around the country in freshwater. He goes, you really, you know, don't say no to me on this. And, you know, when Lefty asks you to do something, it's like, you know, it's like the Godfather asking you to do something, you know, you just say, okay, I'll do it. So I agreed to do it. And then I put the outline together, and I spoke to people all around the country that are big fly anglers for striped bass, just to get their take on what it's like out by them. And guys like Dan Blanton on the West Coast, and Dave Whitlock in Oklahoma, and Bill Butts in Missouri, in that area of the south central part of the country. And just talk to a lot of people. Blaine Chocolate in Virginia is a dear old friend of mine. And so we just, you know, just spoke to them, and I just kind of found out what I already had known, but I needed that to be, you know, qualified, that stripers don't know where they live. So a guy fishing for them in San Luis out in California, Northern California, versus a guy fishing Norfolk Lake versus a guy fishing Smith Mountain Lake in Virginia. And here in Lake Lanier in Georgia, you know, we all have the same problems, and we all find the same patterns. And so basically they don't know where they live. And so they all kind of react the same way. So anyway, long story short, I put the book together, and it took a little bit longer, Justin, than what I thought it would take. Lefty got sick and passed away while I was in the writing of it. And the minute he passed away, it hit me like a ton of bricks. You know, it was almost like losing a second dad. I was very close with him. And so I didn't pick the book up for about 7 or 8 months. I just, you know, I guided, but I didn't even fun fish a whole lot for myself. I just, you know, realized later that I was grieving. I just had no interest in doing all that stuff. And finally I got out of that funk and finished up the book. And I called Dave Whitlock and said, Dave, I'm writing this thing. Would you write the foreword? And he goes, man, not only would I write the foreword, how would you like some illustrations for the book? And, you know, that was, you know, I was over the moon to have Dave Whitlock, who's one of the great fishing artists in our industry, you know, want to offer up some of his illustrations on temperate bass or stripers and hybrids. And he did, and we got it done, and the book is now out. It was released about 3-4 weeks ago. It just got out on for sale, and so you know, it's available on Amazon and Books a Million, and Barnes and Noble. And, you know, then there's places like Flyman Fishing Company is selling it, as well as fly shops around the country. It's Skyhorse produced it, which is the old Lions group, Nick and Tony Lions. They're the guys that published the book. So we'll see. You know, it seems like it's doing well. I don't know. They haven't really said much. And so we're just getting out and promoting it now. So, like I said, I was very blessed to have a lot of friends in the industry who were able to help out and lend either advice or photos and whatnot to get this thing done. I was very, very fortunate when it came to photography. Josh England was my photographer in the book. I also had a few from David Cannon. And these are two guys that have written for just about every fly fishing publication out there. And they happen to be friends that live here in North Georgia that happen to love striper fishing. So they had a lot of photographs that we were able to pillage from. And that, to me, that's really what made the book, is we've got just great, very artistic photos and a lot of photos of explaining to folks what to do and how to target these things. You know, it's not a lot of stuff about just showing fish and pictures of hero shots. But, you know, when we talk about in the book fishing a blow through, you know, we took a picture of what a blow through looks like from above, you know, using a drone. So you could clearly see what a blow through is. Same thing when we talk about fishing like pockets. We use terminology like fishing pockets. And a lot of guys just don't know, you know, when you're talking about a lake, what's a pocket? Well, we took a drone shot and showed people what pockets are. So we're hoping it's going to be enough to get people started.
Cool. And the book is called Fly Fishing for Freshwater Striped Bass, correct?
Yep. Yes. That's the name of the book.
Pretty straightforward.
You know, interestingly enough, Justin, there are one of our bait and tackle shops here that does very little fly fishing, but is on Lake Lanier, is selling the book as well, Hammond's Fishing Center, just because while it's called Fly Fishing for Freshwater Stripers, truth be known, of the 9 chapters, 2 are probably dedicated to fly fishing with regards to tackle, flies, lines, yada, yada, yada. The other 7 chapters really are all about how to locate and find striper and hybrid fisheries on lakes and rivers around the country. So even if you're a conventional guy and you're listening to the February podcast here, there's enough in it. Even if you're not a fly fisherman, you're going to get enough out of that book to get you started in the right direction for these fish.
Cool. And, you know, getting back to talking about patterns, you mentioned that, you know, yourself and some of the other dedicated bass fishermen around the country kind of all end up fishing somewhat similar flies. Can you tell me about your series of flies? Because I know you've developed several.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm with Umpqua Feather Merchants. I started out many years ago with Orvis. I was on their royalty fly designer program, and I skipped over to Umpqua, and I've been a royalty tire for those guys for probably close to 20 years now. And, you know, 90% of my flies are flies for saltwater or warm water use. They're flies for stripers and bass, false albacore, you know, things of that nature, snook. And then a little more recently, the most recent fly I've got out with them is a redfish fly called the Redfish Scampi. And that came from a fly that Umpqua took from me back in the early 2000s, which is called a bonefish scampi, which is, you know, easily one of their top bonefish flies that they sell when they put a package of flies together. If you wanted to just buy like their Bahamas selection or their flat selection, and they give you, you know, 10 different flies in an assortment, the bonefish scampi is one of them. It's just been a really good pattern for catching bonefish all around the world. And so that morphed into the redfish scampi, which is very similar, just tied bigger and in different colors to provoke a redfish to eating the fly in shallow water. You know, it looks like a shrimp type pattern. And but most of my flies, you know, I will say this, you know, there's two types of tires out there, Justin, when it comes to tying. This is the way I see it. There's guys, and we all go back to, you know, Bob Popovich once said, a fly should be designed to solve a problem. And those were brilliant words, and he's right. And so there are flies, there are guys that tie flies that are innovators. You know, guys like Popovich and Chocolate and Charlie, you know, Blaine Chocolate and Charlie Bisharat and, you know, Joe Blados with his crease fly and Bob Clouser and David Nelson. These are guys that are, that have.
Dave Whitlock.
Dave Whitlock, for sure. These
Dave
guys.
One, you know.
Yeah. I mean, so these guys have come out with, and the guys I'm naming are mostly saltwater type guys, you know, saltwater and warm water type fly guys. And they've designed flies that are just the most innovative, never been seen before. And then there are guys that tie what I like to call guide flies, where they may take a pattern, find that there's an issue with something, and they, for lack of a better term, they build a better mousetrap. And right. Whether it's adding, you know, different materials that make a big difference, or putting a lip on a fly, or just changing it slightly, you know, that's the realm I fall in. I'm not an innovative tire. You know, I'm not a Blaine Chocolate or a Bob Popovich or a Dave Whitlock. I tie guide flies that work in certain situations that I needed to correct. And, you know, one of my early flies that I designed, and this is coming from, I fished conventional long before I was a fly fisherman in New York City. And my best striper lure back in the day was a lure called a Roadrunner. And a Roadrunner is similar to a bucktail jig, but it has a spinner blade on the front. And I used to be on the rocks fishing a Roadrunner, and I would outfish four guys lined up on either side of me. I'd outfish them 5-1 because of that spinner blade. So when I got into fly fishing and the first thing I said is, how do I design a Roadrunner for fly fishing? And I looked at the Clouser Minnow, which was tied with all bucktail at the time. And I said, well, that's a good design. Now let me just add a spinner blade to that and put some rabbit on there to get more wiggle in there to get it to breathe more. And all of a sudden, you know, we had a fly called the Coyote that to this day is still being tied by Umpqua and is a very successful fly. And the reason it's called the Coyote, if you remember the cartoon, the Roadrunner, what followed the Roadrunner?
The Coyote.
There you go. So that's how that fly, because it was designed after a Roadrunner lure for fly fishermen. So it got its name, the Coyote. And so, or the Coyote, either one. Either way, you fish it, you got to howl at the moon. You know, that's all you need to know.
That thing would tear the smallmouth up around here, I'm certain of it.
Yep.
Looking at it right now.
Yeah, it's a really good fly. Talking about smallmouth, one of our buddies in the industry, Brad Beefus, who's the president of Cy Anglers, he said is his favorite smallmouth fly to use. So, you know, it's a good fly. There's a lot of good flies, you know. You know, the hardest part, getting back real quick to the book, was, you know, you could write a whole book on striper flies. There's not, you know, there's probably 500 flies that would take a striped bass. So, you know, my whole thing, it's flies are so subjective that the easy thing to do was to just say, I'm gonna put together a list of the top 13, a baker's dozen of 13 flies, some top water, some subsurface. And in these 13 flies, if you put them in a box and start in California and drive east to Pennsylvania, you'll be able to catch stripers in any lake or river across the country. And so that's kind of what we decided to do in the book.
Got it. Well, Henry, this has been a highly entertaining and informative conversation for me. Really can't thank you enough for taking the time to chat with us and share all of your knowledge on bass fishing. And it's just been a treat. But I'd love to hear one more personal fly fishing story from the archives, if you've got you got one more for us.
I've got a quick one for you. And this happened to me back in the early 2000s. You know, I used to, and I haven't done it in the last year and a half because of COVID, or last year, but I was a member of the Yellow Dog advisory team for for back in the day. And so I ran trips all over the world with fly fishermen. And one day I ran a trip into Abaco in the Bahamas, and we were fishing Rickman's Lodge in Sandy Point. And there were, I took myself and seven other anglers, eight of us went out, and we get in the boat one morning and we all take off and go in different directions. And my guide that day, along with my fishing companion, decided we're going to go fish the Marls. It's about a 50-minute run, but we're going to go fish the Marls, which is a very famous bonefish area in the Bahamas. And we went back into the Marls, and we got about 2 miles into the Marls, and we were fishing and catching fish and having a ball. And all of a sudden, it's about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, Justin, and the guide starts up the engine, gives it the gas to go, and we spun the prop. And are you familiar with spinning in the prop, what that means?
Yeah, I have witnessed that before, not on a boat that I've been on, but I've heard of it.
Yep, so the prop didn't seal with the hub any longer, and so the prop spins but doesn't catch, so that you can't go anywhere. It just spins, but the boat doesn't move. And here we are 2 miles back in the Marls, in the middle of nowhere, at 1:30 in the afternoon, and I look at my guide and I said, Kendall, no problem, dude. Just call Ricardo, who owns the lodge. I said, call Ricardo up and have him come get us. And he looks at me, goes, oh man, I dropped my phone in the water 2 weeks ago. I hadn't had a chance to get a new phone, so I don't have anything to, I have no way of calling him. And I'm looking, I'm going, you gotta be kidding me. So here we are 2 miles in the Marls, and I'm like, now what do we do? So I look at my buddy Ricky, who's with me, and Ricky's like, look, we got to fix the hub. I said, okay. He goes, we got to take the cotter pin out, take the prop off, and we got to screw screws into the rubber hub, and then put the prop back on, put the cotter pin back on, and hopefully that will be enough grip to catch the prop. And I'm like, okay. So he takes out, the guy takes out this old rusted screwdriver, and we find a couple screws in the boat that, you know, were coming out. It was an old, you know, whatever it was, a Dolphin skiff back in the day. We take out two screws, we take the prop off, and we put the screws into the prop, and we start to go, and we get up to about 5 miles an hour. It's working. And all of a sudden, we probably went about 200 yards, and he gives it the gas and he spun the prop again. Well, I'm going to tell you, to make a long story short, Justin, this went on for the next 3 hours. We kept taking screws off the console and around the boat. Wherever we saw a screw, we just kept taking screws off, fixing the hub, screwing it in, putting the prop back on and going. And after he spun the prop about 5 or 6 times, I just said, look, we're going to do this again. You're not going to go above 5 miles an hour. Get us out of the Marls. And so sure enough, we took two more screws. We put it in. I'm guessing at this point, we've got 14, 16 screws in this hub. And finally, it works. And he doesn't go above 5 miles an hour. And he gets us out to the opening, back to the ocean. And as the sun is setting at 7:30 at night, we see a boat coming in the distance, and it was Ricardo, and he had found us, and he towed us back to the dock, back at Abaco at Rickman's Lodge. And I swear to you, Justin, when we got back to the dock, you could have taken the console and lifted it up and put it on the dock. There was not a screw left in that boat. We had unscrewed the entire boat to get out of the Marls. So that we could get back to civilization. We were already rationing, you know, nutrition bars and water. We had already planned on spending the night in that skiff. But fortunately, we were found and we made it back. And from that day forward, any trip that I've ever gone on where I've gone in an outfitter to one of these countries out of, I don't want to call it a third world, but one of these non-USA kinds of outfitting lodges, I make sure that the lodge manager has written down where every guide is going every day, because I don't trust satellite phones and everything else, batteries, this and that. I want my people knowing. If something happens, I want to know the area where they're fishing. And what a lesson learned that was.
Well, I guess that which doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
That's right. That's right.
You bet. You bet. Well, Henry, folks can find you at, is it henrycohenflyfishing.com?
Yep, C-O-W-E-N, henrycohenflyfishing.com.
Yep, they can track you down there. You have an Instagram account?
I do. It's just under Henry Cowan.
Okay, Henry Cowan on Instagram. And look for the book, Fly Fishing for Freshwater Striped Bass, available on Amazon. And where else did you say, other than fly shops?
You can get it from Flyman Fishing Company. You can get it from Books A Million, Barnes & Noble. And I have some limited edition hardcover copies. It's a softcover book. It retails for $16.99. The hardcover edition is $35 shipped for a limited edition autographed hardcover edition from me if they're interested. And they can just email me. They can get my email address from the website, from henrycowanflyfishing.com.
Go to thefebruaryroom.com where you can access a complete library of our podcast and read more about our guests, their fishing stories, and favorite fly patterns. We're always looking for exceptional fly fishing yarns. And if you have one to spin, shoot us an email at info@thefebruaryroom.com. The February Room is always free, but if you feel like throwing a nickel in the pond, we appreciate any additional listener support. For companies and individuals interested in sponsorship opportunities, please contact us for our media kit. Thanks for stopping by the February Room, and we'll see you down here next week.